A proposal from the Trump administration could affect more than 4,500 Hmong and Lao residents living in the United States. The government is working on a deal that would allow U.S. officials to deport people who are not citizens and have committed crimes or have deportation orders. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. And we're taking your calls. What have you heard about the evolving policy among residents in the U.S.? Maybe something concerns you, or maybe you think changes need to happen. Perhaps you live in a Hmong community. How could this affect your life? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Rob Menser is Wisconsin Public Radio's Rural Communities reporter. He joins us from our studios in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about this potential deportation policy?
Well, there is a lot that we don't know. The State Department has confirmed that it is calling on Laos to accept U.S. residents who have a deportation order against them. That's a relatively small number of the overall U.S. Hmong population. Most people who are Hmong in the U.S. are U.S. citizens, and most who are not U.S. citizens do not have deportation orders against them. But there is evidence that the State Department is in negotiations and is trying to increase the number of deportations that it can accomplish. And that has set off a lot of alarm, a lot of worry, and some protests among those who say that this would not just tear apart families in the U.S., but also potentially put these individuals at risk.
So it wouldn't apply to Hmong who are U.S. citizens, but what about people who have green cards but aren't citizens? Would it affect them?
So it could. What can happen is the way that someone can get a deportation order is if they've committed a crime or just are charged with a crime but are not a U.S. citizen, they don't have quite the same sort of legal due process rights, and it can result in a deportation order even if, for instance, the person has served their time and it could be decades in the past, even if in some cases the individual has not been found guilty. If you're a green card holder is somebody who is a legal permanent resident of the U.S. and can live here, but as a non-U.S. citizen, they don't have the same set of legal rights. So when there is when there are charges that come up, that person can become vulnerable.
Rob Menser is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau, and we're talking about potential changes when it comes to certain Hmong residents here in the United States and deportation. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What question do you have? 800-642-1234. Rob, as this news has come out, we've seen politicians reacting to it and reacting to their constituents' concerns. Who have we heard from? What are they saying?
Absolutely. This sort of surfaced with a letter sent to U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo from Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum, who's a Democrat in Minnesota, who wrote that it's come to her attention that the Trump administration is negotiating with Laos on these deportation agreements. This letter was made public, and that spread quickly and sort of set off this the current news, and that's led to protests. A number of people who have been calling senators and representatives. So I'm one of them, right? I've as a journalist have reached out to Wisconsin politicians and have heard Republicans such as U.S. Senator Ron Johnson or Representative Mike Gallagher have said that they are seeking more information. They were hesitant to come out with a strong statement against this, but they did say Ron Johnson put out a statement that said he urges State Department to be cautious about this power and that he's seeking more information on it. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who I guess we'll hear from on the morning show shortly, has put out a strong statement against this and on the premise that it would tear apart families and damage Wisconsin communities.
And how has the Hmong community in Wisconsin responded to all of this then?
So I think that they're that they, like anyone else, is looking for more information on this. The Hmong leaders that I've spoken to are somewhat hesitant because there is we don't know what the sort of end result of this will be. But at the same time, there's a strong impulse to raise an alarm. They want to highlight how remote the Laos is for most, virtually all Hmong people who live here. Many of these cases involve people who've been here since they were young children. That's a very common case of somebody who is a green card holder who is Hmong in the U.S. They came over as refugees when they were 3 or 4 or 5 years old in the 80s or 90s, and now today they are green card holders and potentially that's the group that could be at risk here. So that's a very that's a story that Hmong leaders are trying to highlight because that's there's a resonance there that does it make sense to deport these people to Laos?
This change would affect thousands of people, not hundreds of thousands or millions. And this wouldn't be the first time in history that Hmong residents in the U.S. have been deported. What's the context for the Trump administration's stance here?
Right. So, yes, it should be said, like, the number of deportations to Laos in the past, decade has not been zero, right? The data shows that, in the early 2000s, it was tended to be in the 200s per year, and more recently, it's been hovered around 100 per year. That is the status quo. That is a tool that the U.S. government uses and has used for decades. So the concern here is that this is ramping up, and that would be consistent with the Trump administration's sort of overall approach on a sort of hardline immigration policies. That would be consistent with the rhetoric of the president. And so that's a concern, is that this could take the status quo and amp it up. That has not happened yet, but that is the worry.
Knowing that the status quo is not zero, and it wasn't zero under President Obama, it wasn't zero under President Bush.
That's exactly right. And it's in the hundreds. It's not a large number, relative to the overall population of hundreds of thousands of Hmong U.S. residents and citizens. That is the case. As people make the case, there's credible threats that these people face real persecution under the communist government of Laos. Hmong have faced real, true, horrible human rights abuses in the fairly recent past. And so some people would argue that the number should be zero.
And do we know whether that threat of persecution in Laos has weight in these negotiations between the U.S. and the communist government?
We don't. One would think it would have some weight, but it's really hard to know, right? I got a statement from the U.S. State Department that said the U.S. government is funding a reintegration program in Laos for those who need extra assistance, which does not sound the same to me as a expression of concern about human rights violations or an attempt to ensure the safety of these individuals. But maybe that's also sort of diplomatic language, and maybe those things are going on. It's really hard to know. We do not know.
Yeah, a lot of unanswered questions, but thank you for letting us know what those are and also what we do know. Rob, we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. He joined us from our studios there. Up next, we're talking with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, and there's room for you in our conversation. What do you want to know? What do you want to tell her about your life here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and United States Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us now to talk about what's happening in our nation's capital. And we have a line for you, 800-642-1234. What do you want to ask the senator? What do you want her to know about your priorities and how she can best represent you in Washington? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us. The address is ideas@WPR.org. Voters elected Tammy Baldwin to the U.S. Senate in 2012. She previously represented the Madison area in the U.S. House for 7 terms. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a delight to join you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And this is the first time we've talked to you since President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate.
And yes.
So why did you vote to convict the president in that trial?
You know, I took an additional oath on top of my oath of office to do impartial justice. And we had opening arguments, 24 hours almost of opening arguments. And in listening, I was absolutely convinced that the president solicited foreign aid to look into one of his potential political rivals, that he also was trying to pursue a discredited conspiracy theory about who interfered with our 2016 elections. And I was able to reach those conclusions even without the calling of witnesses, but I feel that the failure of my colleagues, particularly on the Republican side, to agree to hear directly from firsthand fact witnesses, John Bolton, Mick Mulvaney, two other high-ups in the White House, who had directly witnessed these activities, I felt that that was also a failure and further evidence of the second article of impeachment, which was obstruction of Congress in doing its investigation. And so that is how I cast my vote. And I will say that in the days since, I have been dismayed at further activities on the part of this president, whether it's firing of an honorable patriot, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and his twin brother, who has had nothing to do with this case directly, or his intervening in another case, asking the Department of Justice to change the sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone. All of these seem to be a president acting with impunity after the acquittal.
Senator Baldwin, turning away from impeachment now, you've proposed legislation that would lower the cost of prescription drugs, something that's certainly on the mind of people in Wisconsin. What are you calling for?
Well, I think that we've heard a lot of promises from this administration, but we haven't seen the kind of results that will make a difference in people's lives, especially those who depend on life-saving prescription drugs or very specific treatments for conditions, chronic conditions, et cetera. This weekend, I'm going to be having some roundtables with constituents in Milwaukee tomorrow, Wausau on Monday, to hear from Wisconsinites who are struggling to afford the medicine they need. And I'm calling on Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican leader of the Senate. He sets the agenda to bring to the floor for debate and a vote legislation that is already passed the House of Representatives. It contains a bipartisan proposal of mine called the Fair Drug Pricing Act, which would basically stand up to the big drug companies to require absolute transparency about how they set their list prices. And it also calls for Medicare to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry for lower drug prices.
We're speaking with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, and right now we're talking about prescription drug prices. There's also a line for you at 800-642-1234. What would you like to share with the senator as she represents you in Washington? 800-642-1234. Senator Baldwin, I wonder if this these measures for prescription drugs are enough. I mean, certainly we see a push in the presidential campaign from the Democrats that there are some that think a single payer plan would be better and would help resolve these issues. How do we figure out how to really fix this? Is this the right way?
Well, my Fair Drug Pricing Act, I think, is a crucial step in all of this. It's a step that relates to transparency. Right now, you cannot get an answer out of our Department of Health and Human Services or others that have direct oversight over the pharmaceutical industry over how their pricing schemes and structures even work. It is the drug companies that set the list price, but then there's this intermediary called pharmacy benefit managers that negotiate discounts and rebates. It's completely opaque. And until we are able to hold the drug companies accountable for the setting of list prices that are reasonable, they're going to take advantage of a system that shrouds their activities in secrecy. Frankly, you know, probably the best example that people remember from a few years back is when the company that makes the EpiPen, which people with severe allergies depend upon to often save their lives if they are, you know, stung by a bee or are exposed to something that they're desperately allergic to, they doubled the price. And for parents of children going back to school, you know, they could fill their prescription, but the school said, we need another EpiPen here. They often couldn't afford to protect their children. And there was no explanation given for why they doubled their price overnight. But we see this in drugs, for example, insulin.
And actually, if I could hold right there, we actually have Chris from Toma on the line who'd like to talk with us about insulin. Chris, what's your story?
Hi, I'm a teacher, and I'm a special education teacher, and I have two masters. And I love my job, I love my students, but I've been diabetic since 98. And since, you know, Act 10 passed, I can't even afford my insulin or strips to check my blood because it's so high. My doctor does give me samples and, you know, stuff they can help me with, but my health has declined. And, of course, being around sick kids, you know, it affects my sugars and everything. So it's frustrating to me, somebody who works all the time and does a good job, and I can't even afford the stuff that I need to survive.
Yeah, Chris, I'm sorry to hear that. And thanks for your willingness to share this with Senator Baldwin. So these are the stories that we encounter, Senator.
Absolutely. And I hear them all the time. And it's why I really want to hold the drug companies to account. You know, insulin is not a new drug that has been, you know, there's no recent developments in terms of reformulating insulin. It's been around for years, and why they're arguing that they need to keep on increasing the price and increasing the price is without reason and rationale. And I don't think they should be able to just use secrecy and an opaque system to make it more difficult for policymakers to see what's actually going on. You know, our Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, is somebody who I've been in long dialogue about this. He comes from the pharmaceutical industry. He used to be an executive at Eli Lilly, which produces insulin. And even he has not presented a satisfactory explanation to me or other members of the Senate and House as to why they've had to literally double prices in recent years. And we've got to hold them to account. So the legislation that passed the House is a very comprehensive look at this. Not only does it include My Fair Drug Pricing Act, which would produce the necessary transparency, but it goes well beyond that, especially enabling Medicare to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for lower prices. You know, sometimes we wonder why it's half the price in Canada and in European countries and other countries across the globe. Same companies, same drugs, and yet because we don't use the clout of large programs like Medicare with over 40 million participants, we could get those same low prices. And it seems ridiculous that the majority in the Senate is protecting these pharmaceutical companies rather than the constituents who sent them there.
Senator Baldwin, so much to talk about, always so little time. Thanks for breaking down impeachment and your prescription drug plan for us. And we'd love to have you back in the future. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Tammy Baldwin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate. We invite all of our members of Congress on periodically to talk with you, our listeners, about what's happening in Washington and give you an opportunity to share your experience with our elected officials. Up next is news, and then we'll hear from the host of Wisconsin Foodie about what the show is digging into in this new season. I'm Keely Boltina, and it's all happening here on The Morning Show. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. And when the occasional lazy Saturday strikes, we have a tendency to get a little stir crazy at our place. So we've been known to pile into the minivan, take the back roads, and scope out the Main Street Cafe in whatever town we encounter. And let me tell you, Wisconsin's food options do not disappoint. There's a line for you in this discussion about Wisconsin's culinary scene. It's 800-642-1234. Are you a Wisconsin foodie? What do you love about food here in Wisconsin? What do you think people should know about your part of the state and the local treats that they should be trying? 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Talking about the latest food finds featured in PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Foodie, our guest is James Beard-nominated chef Luke Zahm. He owns the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, and he's host of Wisconsin Foodie. Luke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, you kick off this new season of Wisconsin Foodie by visiting a meat market in Sheboygan. What did you learn about, making brats and, of course, cooking them to perfection?
Sheboygan was an amazing experience. I think of like all the iconic pieces that, you know, people from outside the Midwest perceive of us as Wisconsinites. And Sheboygan, for a large part, like really embodied that experience. Being able to go into a meat field and be with the third generation, you know, meat market owner and brat maker and kind of just see the behind the scenes. I think that there's an old adage, like you love the sausage, but you never want to see how it's made.
That's what I was thinking. Yep. Mm-hmm.
They really kind of proved that theory wrong. And I loved the fact that everyone in the place was so passionate about what they were doing and how they were doing it. There was so much tradition and pride in that episode and in those people in general, that it made it hard not to be absolutely crazy for it.
Do you have a quick tip about cooking them the right way?
Slow and low is literally the best advice I can give. So the thing that actually struck me when we were cooking the sausages outside of Meesfeld is they had almost let the fire go out on the grill. So they could, you know, usually I do the hand test where I can put my hand over the coals to kind of see how hot they are. And you could very comfortably have your hand over it. But that process really allowed all the juices and the fat to stay inside the sausage where it was intended, as opposed to those blowouts, which are kind of unsightly.
Yeah, and you lose a lot of the flavor, a lot of the you know, the goodness of the food when that happens to you. We know that this episode takes you to Sheboygan to learn about hard rolls too. So, what's tricky about making these rolls?
Well, you know, I think, to be honest with you, Keely, one of the things that was really, really tricky for me is I'm not as skilled in the pastry arts or the bakery arts as I am in the culinary side. So we visited a couple different bakeries in Sheboygan. And I'll tell you, the city bakery, Rick and his crew up there, they have a fine establishment. But I feel like that morning they got their money's worth out of me when we were shooting. I was there for about 6 hours, and I found myself, like, forming the dough. I found myself, like, actually loading the ovens, which is an incredible feat, given that all these hard rolls are loaded onto, like, a 15-foot wood paddle. Whoa. That's very, very skinny. And so, like, it takes an artisan touch to get them off of the paddle and onto the stone deck oven and keep that process going. And everything in that bakery operation is efficient. So for me, it was really, really eye-opening to see, again, the amount of cultural pride that goes into, you know, something that can be taken for granted, like what you put that bratwurst on. In Sheboygan, that is definitely not the case. They take their brats and their patties and their buns very, very seriously.
Luke, did you drop any of those?
No, I didn't.
Wow. Well done. It sounded like it needed a lot of finesse, so I had to ask. The Sheboygan way is, I understand, eating a double brat on a hard roll. Is this now the best way to eat brats? Do you admit this?
So, yes, I will admit this. And I will say that Meatfeld's brat is totally fantastic. It is definitely the best bratwurst I've ever had. I have to say, though, the thing that really, really struck me, I've always grown up eating my brat with kraut and mustard, and maybe a little bit of onion, but, you know, that was absolutely not the case in Sheboygan. They were really, really opinionated about what actually went on their brat. So I would say, when in Sheboygan, eat it as they do. Eat that double brat on a hard roll with a little bit of onion and mustard. But, you know, I think around the state, we all have our own way that we love the bratwurst.
Sure. Save face. Be careful with the condiments. I like that. You also have an upcoming episode about cheese making when we're staying in Sheboygan at Three Sheeps Brewing. Give us a preview of what we can expect from cheese making there.
So, you know, one of the things that actually struck me, we were in a cold storage facility outside of Plymouth, Wisconsin. And in that facility, there were 60 million pounds. And I don't say that lightly, 60 million pounds of cheese waiting to be shipped. The absolute enormity of, like, walking down a canyon of cheese was not a thing that we took lightly at all. It felt like there was a tremendous responsibility to tell the story of the dairy producers here in Wisconsin, but also to evangelize, like, about the cheese that's being produced in that area. More cheese crosses the center line of Plymouth, Wisconsin than any other place on the planet on a yearly basis. So, it is very, very important. But we got in tight with Deer Creek, and Chris and his crew have been making fantastic cheeses. And we go through the whole process of what we look for when we actually taste cheddar, which is something that I adore. Because, you know, when I have young cooks that come into the restaurant, or I hear people say, like, I hate mushrooms. I'm not actually really that interested in what you like and don't like. I want to know why. What is it you taste when you're tasting it? And I think that that's an amazing exercise with young cooks, but it also works really well with my kids. If they don't like something, ask them what they're tasting and why it is that they don't agree with it. And that whole episode is really an homage to that idea. What is it that we're tasting? What makes this some of the best cheese on the planet? And why is there this fanaticism about Wisconsin cheese, which is arguably, and in my mind, the best in the world?
We are catching up on the new season of Wisconsin Foodie airing on PBS Wisconsin. Hoke Luke Zahm is talking about the season and also exploring Wisconsin's culinary scene with us. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Which chefs are doing creative things with food in your community? Which restaurants keep you coming back, or your favorite locally owned ones? If somebody comes to your part of Wisconsin, what do they have to try before they leave town? 800-642-1234. You can also send us a tweet. We are at WPR Mornings. Luke, how does Wisconsin Foodie decide to highlight different aspects of one culinary scene? This time it's Sheboygan.
Sure. We're always looking for great stories. You know, we definitely pride ourselves as being storytellers, and we definitely think that that's a big part in shaping the Wisconsin identity, the food identity. We have like this growing pain that I think the state we're going through right now, where we take our food very, very seriously here in Wisconsin and in the upper Midwest. But we also feel a little bit undervalued on the national scene. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that the Midwest is flyover country when it comes to food. So we want in the show to highlight these people who are literally cultural warriors, holding on to, you know, traditions that have been passed down to them over generations that give this place shape and meaning. And we're always trying to cultivate those stories, because we think in the storytelling itself is where we find a renewed sense of identity and a bridge to push this place forward.
We've talked about your passion for telling stories from rural communities. Are chefs and cooks in these rural communities facing different challenges than their peers in more urban centers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the struggle is real everywhere. The thing that's happening in rural communities in Wisconsin that we've seen, you know, a lot of times they get kind of they get overlooked as far as being places that are very welcoming to new population sets. Viroqua, where our restaurant is and where we live, you know, it has a relatively diverse population. And as cooks in those places, you know, we have to be a little bit more traditional in the way that we recruit. So most of our cooks actually start as dishwashers. And we take the time to cultivate the experience of working in a business environment, of developing teamwork, of developing their palate to be able to execute amazing food on a daily basis. I think over the past, you know, 15, 20 years, there's been kind of a departure from that, where you see, you know, kids coming up and wanting to be executive chefs right out of the bat. And in rural communities, that's just not possible. So it takes a little bit of finesse to try and teach people that they have to cultivate this idea of being a chef and really finding their own food identity.
Is that inherently better or worse than going to school, getting a culinary education, and then becoming an executive chef right away?
You know, I don't think that it definitely is better or worse, to be fair. I think it's different. I think that there is sometimes humility in it. And one of the reasons, actually, that I love cooking is that it is actually, you know, it's tactile. I'm using my hands and all my senses. And I think that when you learn on the job, there's a humility that kind of comes with that. I really, really appreciate that. Knowing that I can walk into just about any kitchen and I may not be the best chef in the kitchen. As a matter of fact, I know most of the time I'm not. But because I've had to scrap for it and I worked my way up, I know that I can work with anybody. There's something really, really endearing in that.
Luke Zahm stays with us. He's a chef, a restaurant owner, and the host of Wisconsin Foodie. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the program? Or maybe you'd like to share what's special about food in your neck of the woods. 800-642-1234. The conversation continues here on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin Foodie introduces you to the people who grow and prepare food for a living. And host Luke Zahm is talking about the culinary excitement that the show is highlighting this season. And we want to hear from you. What is happening in your community that is creative when it comes to food. Or maybe there's a long-running restaurant decades in the making that keeps you coming back. Perhaps you are a chef or an amateur cook and you'd like some tips. You have something to share with us. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also send us an email at ideas@WPR.org. And Luke, I'm wondering, what are you seeing when producing this season and traveling across the state that are new trends emerging in Wisconsin's culinary scene?
Sure. As far as new trends are concerned, I mean, I think some of the things that we're seeing are stronger affiliations with some of the cultural differences or different cultures that exist within the state. So being able to work with a Hmong farmer, Bao Xiong, and her dad and mom, Kia Lee, in the La Crosse Cameron Park Farmers Market, learning a lot about that food, but we're also getting a lot of feedback about, you know, trying to understand more about the Hmong community or the Laotian community. The other trends that we're seeing is not all of these food entrepreneurs have restaurants. So there's a lot more pop-ups happening. We're also seeing that, you know, kind of that idea of like one restaurant, one space, moving through to some of the food halls. I know like the Zocalo, the Food Trailer Park in Milwaukee is one of those, or the Crossroads Collective in Milwaukee. A lot of different entrepreneurs are in one space, so they offset costs, and it makes this, you know, dining experience where you can show up and you can get five different cultures worth of food in one location, which is awesome.
And sticking with that idea of different cultures and food here in Wisconsin, you mentioned speaking with a Hmong refugee whose family has been farming in the area for almost two decades. There's also Serbian Days Festival in Milwaukee that highlights more cultural inspiration that's here right in Wisconsin.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel absolutely blessed and honored. This last Thursday, when the episode went live on Wisconsin Public Television and Milwaukee PBS, I actually got to be in Three Brothers Restaurant in Bayview in Milwaukee, and I was dubbed an honorary Serbian, which was amazing.
Wow.
I think that's going on my resume. But the love and like the warmth that they exude for their culture and the food that surrounds it, I mean, food is a central piece to a lot of cultural gathering, and it's used as like the balm sometimes when there are differences. So I adore the fact that we've had the opportunity to showcase some of these people coming together and, you know, being able to highlight that for the rest of the state. Go eat this food.
Yeah. And when you're judging, though, you say that you can judge a restaurant by its burger. So are you still exploring new burgers, even though it seems like something maybe everybody kind of has one of?
Yeah, I'm always exploring new burgers.
Why not?
Exactly. If it's not broke, don't fix it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that kind of, for me, is like that hallmark of a standard. If you have a great burger, and most restaurants, you know, if you're going to feature a burger, you want that thing to be a showcase because everybody has one. What makes your burger different? What makes it exceptional? How do you determine what makes a burger exceptional? So, you know, as I travel around and I get the opportunity to eat and eat and eat, you know, I want to see what it is. We obviously want to find the best thing on your menu. And sometimes the burger just acts as that medium of seeing where you're at, taking the temperature, so to speak.
Okay, but let's pull back the curtain. What can you tell about a chef from their burger?
Oh, man. I almost don't want to give away the dirty secrets, but I can tell if, number one, how well you season your food. Number two, I can tell if you're overthinking your menu concepts. I think that there's kind of an axis sometimes between the ability to execute a menu and the creative inspiration behind it. And I think that, you know, sometimes younger cooks are really high on the creative aspect because, you know, why can't we make a buttermilk snow and a nasturtium salad and put that on a menu? Like, what does that even mean? To execute that and have it be tangible for, you know, the dining public to access and enjoy is a completely different story that takes time and technique and talent. So, you know, I can kind of see into a little bit of what's going on there. But you can also see a little bit, you know, the dedication to local sourcing if it's there. I'm always looking for, that local beef, because I think we have such an abundance of great product here in Wisconsin. And, it just allows us to kind of just take a glimpse into what's going on behind the curtain.
All right. We're getting a few trade secrets from Luke Zahm, who's a chef and host of Wisconsin Foodie, airing on PBS Wisconsin. And we're talking about Wisconsin's culinary scene and the new season of the show. And Kelly from Cascade wants to join our conversation. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I run a place that's just north of Beechwood. We're in Sheboygan County, and it's out of our home called The Nurturing Heart. It's rustic Italian cooking. We grow a lot of it on our farm, and we do a lot of experiential dining, cooking classes. We've cooked for couples, bread, pizza, four or five course dinners. But we moved back from, we lived in Colorado and then the Pacific Northwest, and came back to Wisconsin for this very reason, because we just felt like there's so much happening on the food scene, and Wisconsin's got such a good cultural heritage here. My husband's roots are here, and so this just seemed like a great place to do it.
Kelly, thank you so much for sharing about your farm. And Luke, that's certainly an example of the fact that innovation in food is not necessarily happening just in restaurants.
Absolutely. And, I think that she kind of hit on a word there, experiential dining. I can say, honestly, that that's what a lot of diners are coming and looking for, specifically ones that are traveling from outside of, our immediate locale. They want the experience of being immersed in the farming culture and all things Wisconsin when they're dining with us. So awesome.
Okay, so you are seeing a push sometimes, things like, going to a farm. I know some places in the summertime do like pizza nights. So you go to the farm and you eat pizza that's made with all ingredients there. People are interested in those. That isn't a niche thing right now?
No, I think that is actually kind of more and more and more. We see that in the summertime as being the pinnacle of people's, dining experiences. And it really, it changes the paradigm of the whole industry. To go to a farm where, last year, for example, Wisconsin Foodie, we put on a dinner on Andy Hatch's farm in Dodgeville, and we had 100 tickets that sold. And it's this most idyllic setting you can imagine. It's on top of the ridge between Dodgeville and Spring Green, and diners came and we literally immersed them in all these products from the farm. It really helps that storytelling and that narrative of this is who we are and this is where we're from. And we can express that through food, which ends up being a very powerful medium.
Lynn from Racine called but couldn't stay with us, wanted to shout out Wells Brothers Restaurant, known for their pizza in Racine. Says they've been in business for 99 years and are on the fourth generation. So while we're talking about, the newness that's happening in the culinary world, we also see places that have really created a legacy.
That old school. We were actually driving through the scene. We did a couple shoots there this last season, and that name kept popping up and up and up. So kudos to them. As a restaurateur for, we've owned our restaurant for about 7 years now. 99 years is almost unthinkable. And given that most restaurants fail within the first 2 years, they definitely have it figured out. So props to them. I'll be back.
All right. Sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Luke, for taking us around the state, specifically spending a lot of time in Sheboygan and sharing a few secrets with us. We really appreciate it this morning.
Hey, I appreciate all of you. Keep watching. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And we'll make sure that there's a link on our website so that you can see the latest on Wisconsin Foodie. Just go to WPR.org/mornings. Luke Zahm is a James Beard nominated chef and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, and he hosts Wisconsin Foodie. Just ahead, an hour-long conversation about the country's new trade deal with Mexico and Canada. We look at how the deal could affect jobs and businesses here in Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.